our studio doesn't have a signature style. So you look at one project, super minimalist, you look at another project, very maximalist, but that's driven by the aesthetics of the client. And I've never understood when studios have signature style, because I feel that's a bit self-indulgent, it's narcissist. I'm just creating clones of spaces that I may like everywhere in the world. And that is not your objective, being a designer. The objective is really bringing that client vision to life. So I think those differences really come from the client that you're working with.
Welcome to the Design Pataki podcast, a show that deconstructs the Indian and international design world with leading industry experts. I'm Isha Gupta, the founder of Design Pataki. Pallavi Dean is the founder and creative director of Interior Design Studio Raw. Born in India, raised in Dubai, and working in London for years, has lent a unique multicultural influence to Pallavi's designs. A trained architect and sustainability specialist, Pallavi has won multiple awards across a range of sectors. She's a former professor of interior design at the American University of Sharjah and writes for industry publications, assists with key trade events, and mentors students. In 2013, Pallavi launched Pallavi Dean Interiors, which was rebranded as Raw in 2018. Pallavi has been recognized by global media as an emerging designer to watch out for, and her work has been profiled in some of the world's leading international publications. Hi Pallavi, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Isha. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you about the nuances of cross-country design. I think it's something which, you know, working and designing in India, it's something you think about. How do you design internationally? How do you design for a global audience? So the first question I wanted to ask you is, you've worked across 10 countries. And, you know, you've always said that your Indian, Middle Eastern and British cultures have influenced you as a designer. So can you elaborate on how you've built those design sensibilities for yourself?
Sure. I mean, look, Isha, if you're working in Dubai or working in London or you're working in Tanzania, right, you're designing for humans. And what do we humans crave? We crave an experience. And as a designer, I think our fundamental role is to, you know, curate a space or create a vessel for those experiences to come forth. So you start from that point. So I've never really understood like why you can't be an Indian designer working in London or a Dubai designer working in Africa. You know, so for me, that's the starting point. You're designing for human experience. So as you said rightly, I have a lot of cultural tension, you know, growing up. So I'm Indian, but I've never lived in India. My entire family is British. So every time we travel back to the UK, I have to stand in a separate queue. I was raised here in the UAE. I have lived in the UAE for nearly 40 years, you know, my entire life, but I'm not Emirati. So, you know, growing up, there was a lot of this tension, this third culture child, like, who am I? You know, I had a lot of those moments. Where do I belong? But I feel like previously I would look at it as very negative, kind of, it had a very negative connotation. But now as I've grown and matured as a designer, I'm like, wow, I am so blessed that I'm influenced by these three cultures, which is so different, but they do have these commonalities within them. So that cultural tension has actually become, you know, like a shining star in my career and has influenced how I look at aspects of design.
But how would you say are the differences that you've noticed when designing across different countries?
I think few of them are very simple. They're cultural nuances, right? When I design in the Middle East, you know, if we do a big multinational office, and a designer from America will come and be like, hey guys, let's put like a cycle storage and let's put a coat rack. Yeah, no, not happening here. We don't have that cycling to work culture. We don't have raincoats or, you know, winter coats or whatever. So there are those functional things, but also culturally, it is a society that's somewhat segregated. You know, there is, women do feel comfortable in certain zones. Men feel comfortable in different zones. You know, a simple example like a majlis, a traditional hospitality zone within a project, is separate for women and for men. So those are some of the cultural nuances that you find working in the Middle East. And likewise, I think if I look at a project in Africa compared to a project in the UK, the parameters of the project are very different and they're always influenced by the context they're within. So I think anywhere that you work, you first respect the context, the brief, and your design is always in response to that.
Right. But what about in terms of, one is functional aspects and one is in terms of aesthetics. What would be your advice in terms of the more decor and, you know, the look and feel of things?
Yeah, you know, I've never been one of those designers that starts with the aesthetics. I've been a very, our approach in our studio is very evidence-based. So for me, I've always said that, you know, design is part science and part art. And they're always 50-50. So even our kind of tagline of our company is we're 50% wild and we're 50% tame, 100% raw. The wild side is that artistic and creative flair. Now that is subjective. So you, once you understand your client, you understand what their aesthetics are, what is their subjectivity when it comes to, you know, the aesthetic language of the project, and you deliver to that. But the science part, that's objective, right? That's evidence-based, that's functional, that's program-driven, that's brief-driven. And you can't really have a lot of arguments on it. So what we've done is so that we never have a, you know, kind of, so we never have friction with the client is we've developed our own process. We call it user experience design. And it ticks both the artistic sides and sort of the more functional sides, the scientific sides. And one thing that I will always say is that our studio doesn't have a signature style. So you look at one project, super minimalist. You look at another project, very maximalist. But that's driven by the aesthetics of the client. And I've never understood when studios have signature style, because I feel that's a bit self-indulgent. It's narcissist. I'm just creating clones of spaces that I may like everywhere in the world. And that is not your objective, being a designer. The objective is really bringing that client vision to life. So I think those differences really come from the client that you're working with.
I'm really enjoying this conversation, and we were looking at your work. Each one looks very different. There's no common thread that ties it. And you can see that it's very client-driven. But a lot of designers have an issue with that. And I don't know if you've noticed that, but they have a very, like either it would be very French colonial, or they have a very minimalistic take to things, and usually translates through every project. So what made you make that conscious decision to sort of be different in that sense?
Yeah, you know, I always pick this bone with other designers, because when they look at my Instagram page or my website, they're like, who are you? Like, you know, we're minimalist and we're so proud of it, and or we are postmodernist and this is what we do and it's so clear. And I'm like, good, good for you. You've chosen that stream. You row your boat down that stream. The stream I always chose, yes, I may not have a signature style, but I have a signature process. And that process, I know just from the, you know, 20 years of architectural interior design experience, is bulletproof, because I've not had as many clients fall out with me or fire me or not be happy with the end result, because our process is really fail safe. You know, it is bringing that artistic and that scientific side and merging them to create the end result. And I think if you choose that path, you just have more longevity in your career, or you have more consistency in how you deliver. The easiest thing for me would be to have a signature style, so I can duplicate all my details and, you know, oh yes, I did that skirting that way. Let me do it that way every single time. But I'm one of those people who gets bored, you know, so I love meeting new people and seeing what their aesthetic is and helping them bring that to life, rather than just, you know, dominating the process with what I like.
Tell me more about this process, this bulletproof process. I'm sure everyone would love to hear more about it, and how it's something that, I'm assuming, something that goes across all cultures, that works pan-globally. It's something that works naturally.
Yeah. I mean, listen, okay, Isha, I'm saying it's bulletproof. This is my narcissist opinion of it. I ask someone else, they might be like, oh, I don't know what she's talking about. But I tell you what it is, okay? We have a very intensive briefing process, and I always relate it to a psychometric test. So we have a psychologist that comes with a briefing, comes to every client briefing. Because me as a designer, you know, sometimes I get really excited. I'm just like, oh my God, I can do this and I can do this. And she reins me in. She's like, stop. First, let's ask the client, how do they want to feel in the space? What are the characteristics that will make them feel cocooned? What are the characteristics that will bring out the extrovert side of their personality? So number one, it's scientific, because I actually have a psychologist. The other thing is, I also have one of my board members is an economist. So taking him to meetings, I look at things like return on investment. How does footfall equate to the number of tables that I put in this restaurant, or the number of shelves that I put into this retail shop? So that process starts, first of all, with an intensive briefing. I will not hit pen to paper till I have gone through with every client. And I always do the first meeting. And I'm such a control freak. I end up doing the last meeting as well. But, you know, we go through this intensive briefing process and I bring in other professionals. So if I'm doing a workplace, I will bring in the best in class of workplace psychology and he will join that meeting with me. Or, you know, at a home, I take a psychologist because many a times that when we're designing homes, we become marriage counselors. So I think it's always nice to kind of take the psychologist with me at the first meeting. I'm like, if you two can't agree, you need to talk to her. Don't talk to me, you know. And I think this is one way that our process is different. And the other way is also that, like I said, we don't have a signature style, but we do have a design philosophy that every single person in the team adheres to. And, you know, at the end of the day, whether you design in London or Africa or Dubai, you know, there's some common sensibilities in design. You want natural light. You want to flow through space. You want balance. You want a sense of symmetry, a sense of comfort. All of those things, much like the psychometric exam, they're common amongst all cultures, amongst all human beings. So I really don't think I'm reinventing the wheel. I'm just focusing a lot more time on research, which has made our process this. And I think one other thing that differentiates us is our links to academia. Like I teach at university and I'm always looking at these thought papers or these white papers or what new things these students are doing and integrating that within practice. So there's still that connection between theory and the professional world rather than just, you know, flying in the professional world just without any of that academia involved.
When you started, I'm sure there were mistakes and, like, you know, we've all made mistakes when we started. So can you just shed light on some of them? Because it's very relatable when you know that someone's also stumbled a couple of times. So some errors which, you know, you didn't know about, or, you know, you designed something and you found out later that, you know, it doesn't work. So anything like that that's happened.
Yeah, that's a really good question because I could write a book on that because I think anybody who says that they were like born perfect is just so mistaken. I'll start with something which they don't teach you at design school. At design school, they teach you, you know, how to draw a plan, how to pick materials, how to work with proportions. What they don't teach you is emotional intelligence and empathy. So when I was a 22-year-old young architect, I was the most arrogant, cocky, annoying person anyone had ever come across. You know, I remember, at that time, she was a star architect, Hazel Wong. She designed Emirates Towers. I walked, 22-year-old, walked into office and be like, so I'd like to be on a design team and I'll be working on the next tower with you. Like, who does that, right? Now, when I see millennials do this with me, I'm like, oh my God. And I think she just smiled at me and she said, okay, you can start by designing the toilets. And I was like, right. And I think that was my first kind of lesson. You know, and I think I did toilets for a whole year because of that. And it's fine. I just shut up and I did the toilets, you know. So I think one of the biggest lessons I've learned is to be more empathy oriented, empathy based, and just have emotional intelligence, read the room. Again, they don't teach you that in university. But some of the other mistakes I've made, you know, I've specified materials on countertops that are not durable. You know, I was all into this marble phase of mine, did a beautiful restaurant with a marble countertop. And then I saw all those rings that the drinks leave. And now I cringe every time I see someone specify marble, you know, on any countertop or any workable surface. That was a big mistake. I think I'd learned from that. I've also been known in my younger years to have doors that open directly onto stairs. So, you know, there are things you just learn through experience.
You look back. Exactly. And I think that it's very relatable to hear these stories because, you know, especially for listeners who are starting out and, you know, interior designers who are in the beginning of their career, you know, you look up to these designers and you see these perfect Instagram images. So, you know, how everything's beautifully photoshopped and everything looks perfect. So it's nice to hear the other aspect. And tell me some cultural issues that you didn't realize.
You know, Isha, also, let me just, going back to that, I still make mistakes. Let me just be very clear about it. It's not like I've stopped making mistakes. We just finished a spa and I've miscalculated the arch. We'd done these 5-meter arches and one part of the arch was right in front of a door opening. I mean, we could salvage it because we caught it quick enough within the drawing process. But I don't think you ever stop making mistakes because I think that would just be inhuman if you were just perfect and you got everything right. I think it's totally okay to make mistakes. And I tell everyone in my team, please make mistakes. Don't hide them. Don't cover them up because the sooner we capture them, the sooner we can rectify them. So I make mistakes. So what are some of the cultural things? I'll tell you one of the biggest mistakes I think I made. I had a meeting with the royal family here in the UAE. It's a very conservative Muslim kind of society, right? And I think in one of the artworks, I'd shown a naked woman. And I hadn't realized, you know, because I had been working in London, you know, gone to an American university. I was like, oh, check this out. And, you know, everyone's faces fell, but they had such a great sense of humor. They're like, we're not going to be putting that particular painting, but, you know, maybe you could show something else. And I was like, oh, horrified. But you have to do your research when you work in different cultures. So you don't do those faux pas like I made.
And how can you break down Emirati design, if that's even a term that I can put together? I mean, I'm not sure if that's really a thing, but if you were to like break it down, what would you say the UAE sensibilities and how do they differ globally per se?
Look, I think UAE is a very new country, okay? We are finding our design identity. We are finding our design voice. We're only about like 50 years old, you know, it's our 50th anniversary this year. So what is our sensibility? We're figuring it out. So 10 years ago, if you looked back at what was happening in Dubai, it was the tallest, the shiniest, the brightest kind of architectural monument. You know, we had to be in every Guinness Book record. But now we're doing more tasteful, more thoughtful, more thought-provoking kind of architecture. And that happens as you mature, as both as a country and as a, while finding your design voice, you know. So I think now the sensibility is more context-driven. It's more, it's got a real focus on what is the local economy providing in terms of artisans, in terms of designers, in terms of craft. But at the end of the day, the UAE and Dubai in particular is very diverse. I mean, we're a studio of 19 and we have 15 different nationalities within the studio. That is just a testament of the kind of society we are here. So you get a lot of influences from different cultures. People have studied in different universities. You're bringing all of that into this melting pot. And the result you see is what you see in Dubai today. You've got Louvre by John Novell. You've got Museum of Future by a South African architect who's been practicing here for years. So it's interesting. It's very diverse and mixed, I would say.
I think there's been a huge thrust of art and culture in the last couple of years. And I think even the government's put a lot of focus on this aspect with Design Week and Art Dubai and, you know, so many other shows happening. So do you say it's evolved a lot recently? Do you think that change has taken place within, say, the last 4 or 5 years maybe?
Absolutely. You know, our office is in Dubai Design District, a district dedicated to design never existed in the past. And there you have it. It's become this ecosystem that is drawing multinational companies, fashion brands, interior designers, architects. They're all based here. So there has been a huge push by the government. But I think it's just the process of evolution. You know, as you grow and mature as a society and you figure out your design sensibility, you invest more in it. And that's exactly what the government has done, created this infrastructure and this ecosystem that supports people like me, you know, to just express themselves.
True. And, you know, you've known to work with a lot of local artisans or local, basically local designers. How do you integrate that when you're designing for an international project, say something outside the UAE? How do you tie those two together given the, you know, geographical differences?
Yeah, you know, Isha, I try not to tie them together. So we're working on a hotel in Morocco currently. It's an art hotel. And what I'm trying to do is engage the artisans there, you know, and that's what a responsible designer should do. They should take their sensibilities, obviously, but also respect the context where the project is. So when I work in London, I will work with the best joiners, the best artisans in London, because that makes the story more authentic. But how do I help my own society? Like, obviously, you know, I always consider myself as someone from Dubai. I'm an Indian from Dubai. What we do is whenever we work in this part of the world, whether it's Saudi or Bahrain or Kuwait or wherever in the Middle East region, we will take the artisans from here to those other regions. But when we work internationally, we work with the context.
This also brings me to, you know, there are a lot of projects which now are happening virtually, right? And a lot of designers want to design internationally and they're purely Zoom projects where it's completely digital. So one is, what would be your advice in doing digital projects per se, and also sourcing, because I believe a huge apprehension is with sourcing as well.
Yeah. You know, when COVID hit, our supply chain broke down, right? We were designing the spa and I had some karigars in Rajasthan who were carving out this stone for me, which was supposed to fly in, and India was in lockdown. We couldn't get that in. So I think we're all questioning our supply chains. We eventually got it from Oman, which is a neighboring country. We carved it here locally. So the talent is here. So we've started thinking and looking more closely at our supply chains. With this whole digital thing, I did my first project in Zoom over COVID, right? The project was in Doha. I'd been to site before COVID had hit, but, you know, we did all our meetings virtually and they were from 12 different parts. It was a McKinsey office. So people from Amsterdam, people from America, people from South Africa, we all logged into these weekly calls. Was it effective? Of course it was effective. Will anything ever replace being somewhere in person? No way. We've all been able to work from home because we've built up the social capital. You know your team, you know your client, you've got social rapport there, and it's worked. But that's only going to work in the short term. You can sustain it for 12 months, 18 months, but nothing is ever going to replace, you know, being on site, choosing materials, looking at things with your clients, having those workshops or those brainstorming sessions. Nothing will ever replace that. So yes, you can do it, but it's not a long-term solution.
But do you see it's something, because, you know, India is going to, it's going to take time for Indians to sort of, for us to get out of this phase at least. And I personally know a lot of people who are looking at options internationally, but again, the worry is sourcing, the worry is, you know, the designer can't be there. Do you think it's viable to actually do an entire project from scratch to finish? And how do you do it? And what are the challenges that you faced?
I'll tell you what we did in Doha. You know, I don't believe in this siloed kind of living. I'm a designer from Dubai. I'm not going to work with somebody from India or Doha. I collaborated with a firm there because I couldn't do the snagging. So I thought, let me go and find the best firm in Doha, give them a part of my fee. But I want that person engaged too. I want them involved in the design process. I want them to go and check my snagging reports, to go and check if these material colors match. And we did Zoom calls. But I think one way is aligning yourself with the right partner. Okay. Number two, of course we can do things virtually. Think about what we do as designers, right? You start with something in your imagination. You translate that to a 3D model and then it's built on site. So I think a big part of the design process, at least from briefing to sort of scheme design, can be done virtually. But then you collaborate with an architect of record or collaborate with a designer you trust on site to take it through that next or that final stretch.
To represent your vision, essentially.
Yeah, to be the architect of record or the executor on site. But you can make it a more meaningful collaboration if this person actually had links to the local supply chain or understood the procurement or the authority approvals better than you do. Nothing wrong with that, right? You just put it within your fee and it's part of the process.
And what about sourcing? How, I mean, I know you've, you know, you're trying to source locally, but have you face challenges where, you know, you're not, there's not enough information available because it's so fragmented at times?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge every designer faces, but we're so lucky. I remember doing this 20 years ago when I started my career. The internet wasn't that good. You know, you didn't have these websites. You didn't have access to kind of information that we have now. I really think in today's day and age, you're only a phone call or a Google search away from finding the answer. It's just doing your homework.
It's just about putting the hard work in.
Yeah.
And to tell us about some hidden gems you found while you've been sourcing internationally, or some haunts that you have which you must go to, or if you previously when you could, we could all travel freely, like locations you just had to go to.
Oh my God, that's a loaded question. I would never remember the names. I would never remember the names of
or
things I love.
Or a trade show, other than Milan Design Week, a trade show, okay. A small one which you love. Or, you know, it could just be any of those, you know, design heartthrob destinations.
Yeah, I mean, I loved Edit Napoli. Like they did it just before COVID. And I loved that show because it was so bespoke. It was so beautifully curated. I love stuff that's beautifully curated, you know, and it was artisans and designers collaborating and putting up this trade show. I love that. And it allowed us to kind of explore Capri and, you know, the south of Italy. I thought that was fabulous. I love London Design Week. I think that's fabulous. You know, again, you're looking at very experimental installations and really cool talks. I love stuff like that. I love that kind of intellectual stimulation because you get so caught up in the day to day sometimes that you don't engage in that. And I think you mentioned like all of these podcasts, kind of platforms where people are interviewing famous designers. I love that. I'm like a little sponge to that. Previously, we had to travel to get that, but now we have it kind of on demand, you know, on platforms like yours.
No, I completely agree. Sometimes, my team laughs at me because I have fangirl moments with my favorite designers. It's more exciting this way. So I completely understand what you're saying. Let's talk about product design. You know, you've done a couple of very interesting lighting pieces. And again, how have you kept design something which is globally relevant? I think that's the term I'm looking for. Designing something which is globally relevant.
Yeah. You know, I always go back to this thing. We're humans, we crave experience. So I think if you start with the point of designing something that's experience driven, you just can't fail. I never understood this global local conversation. I mean, I get it. Like at some level, I understand it. But I still just think we're all human. We're all kind of comfortable at a certain range of temperature. We're all stimulated, you know, like our senses, whether it's vision or whether it's smell, it's stimulated by certain things. So we have these base markers, which are common to all of us. So when I design products, I just think I'm designing for this type of human, this cool human who wants a light that will talk back to it. And that was a collaboration with Artimede, this interactive system. And that could be again in Dubai, or it could be in India, or it could be in Africa. And I think that type of person who's, you know, tech savvy, who likes interactivity within their space, would gravitate towards that product.
You know, you've spoken about the light and you've spoken about your inspiration behind it. Do you want to talk a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, like, you know, when the world's biggest lighting brand comes and tells you, design a light for me. Come on, you got to be flattered. You got to be like, really? Me? Are you sure? You sure you don't want to be like asking someone else? Like maybe someone Fosters and Partners or something? So first of all, you know, I had to get over that flattery. I had to be like, oh my God, this is happening. No one's going to jump out from behind somewhere and be like, you're such an imposter. So you have to get through your own imposter syndrome to realize that you're at that stage where someone's actually seriously asking you to do something. So that was awesome. And then obviously the connection with the light was also, it was called Interweave. It was about, you know, I always felt that designers are a little bit like bullies. And it goes back to my conversation about signature style. We always impose what we want on other people. So whenever I've designed products, I want people to be able to customize it and make it their own. And that's what Interweave is. It's a series of pods and you select. Is this going to be a downlight? Is it going to be a speaker? Is it going to be a sensor-operated control within it? Or does it measure the temperature in my room? And that's what those pods are in Interweave. And the lighting kind of weaves and connects all of this together. And I think at the time, you know, there was Brexit. As I told you, my family's British and they were talking about, you know, I think my father-in-law voted for Brexit. And I was like, hello, you have a brown daughter-in-law. Are you sure you want to do that? And I think the world was so disconnected. Trump was in power then. And I just thought in a world where everybody's talking about, you know, disconnecting, I wanted a product to build bridges. And that's where that whole concept came from. And I think for me, I always start with narrative or storytelling, as I guess most designers do. And for me, once the story clicked, the product was easy.
That fell into place after that.
Absolutely.
And my last question to you is going to be, what are your, okay, I know this sounds terrible when I say tips, but what is the advice you would give young designers who are looking to design across the globe? And just maybe top three things that they should keep in mind, especially when they're starting out.
Okay, top three things for any young designer. Number one, start with empathy. Start with investing in your bank of emotional intelligence. Read books, go see coaches, do whatever it needs to understand what empathy is and to understand emotional intelligence. Because once you've nailed that, you can talk to anybody anywhere in the world because you get it, right? And you're a good listener. Number two is that connection to academia and research. I think a lot of us, once we leave university, we just focus on the practicalities of the day-to-day of design. And you could never step away from that ivory tower academic thinking because it always comes in handy. So make sure you're very research driven, you know, and I think that will help you work either in Morocco or Islamabad or India or wherever, right? I think that helps with the diversity factor, the research, empathy. And I think the last thing that I would say is kind of, you know, I've always talked about this sense of curiosity. Like, you know, you have to be curious. And I don't think design is something you do from 9 to 5. It kind of extends into everyday moments, you know? So you think about, you know, this light that's hitting my face is really annoying, but I'm also fascinated by how it's making my face look. And I'm thinking, wow, if I could bring that, and I've just come up with this now, I'm like, wow, if I could bring that effect within to a space, that would be interesting. So I think you have to be curious and question everyday moments. And I think the best ideas come from there, because I think people just think that you're born creative or the muse hits you and you run with it. Yeah, that happens in the movies. In the real world, you sit for maybe 10 hours, 10, 12 hours every day and do rubbish work for like 7 days. But then on the 8th day, you've been stimulated by an everyday moment and that idea has been churning in your head and you've been asking that question and suddenly it'll hit you. But it doesn't just suddenly hit you. It hits you because you've put those hours and hours of research, practice, trialing in and experimentation. And that's where it comes from. So I think those would be my three tips.
Let the ideas germinate in your head. So lovely. So I think that runs up our nuances of cross-cultural design. Anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up this podcast?
I think what I'd like to add is a lot of people are talking about kind of the long-term changes of COVID, this pandemic. How is it going to change design? You know, are people going to be always distanced and stuff like that? I honestly think if you look back at other major events like 9/11 or you look back at the Spanish flu, these are little blips in the human history, you know? So we kind of have to just stay true to our design philosophy and move from that point rather than adapting for one pandemic. Because we're quite resilient as a human race.
I mean, we've noticed that. It's been a year and we're still fighting hard. So, yeah, we'll get there at some point of time. So, yeah, so thank you so much, Pallavi, for doing this. This is absolutely enlightening. And hopefully we will see you soon at some point once things open up. And best of luck with everything.
Thank you so much for having me and for creating such good content, for keeping everyone inspired. Thank you.